Good morning and welcome to Focus 580. This is our morning talk program. My name is David Inge, and we're glad to have you listening. In the first hour of the show today, we will explore some of the history of early America and concentrate particularly on one region, that is, the part of the northeastern United States where present-day U.S. and Canada meet. And our guest for the program is Alan Taylor. He's professor of history at the University of California at Davis. And this is something that he is interested in, very interested in, this region, the meeting of the two countries, the issue of how it is that the border came to be settled. And he tells the story in a newly published book. The title of the book is The Divided Ground. And he uses, as a way to frame the story, the lives of two men. One of them was a Presbyterian missionary named Samuel Kirkland. The other was a leader of the Mohawk, Joseph Brant. And they are two men who knew each other well, who perhaps earlier in their lives were friends, later on became enemies. And the dynamic between the two men and the course that their lives took really mirrors the much larger kind of struggle involving the British on one side, the Americans on the other, and the people of the Iroquois Confederation who found themselves in the middle. That is what the book is about. Let me just mention that our guest, Alan Taylor, is also contributing editor at The New Republic and is the author of several other books, including Liberty Men and Great Proprietors, American Colonies, and his book, William Cooperstown, which won both the Bancroft and the Pulitzer Prizes for American History. The new book, The Divided Ground, and the subtitle there is Indians, Settlers, and the Northern Borderland of the American Revolution, is published by Knopf, and it is out now just recently. I'm sure you can find it in the bookstore if you'd like to take a look at it. And, of course, questions are welcome. All we ask is people just try to be brief so that we can keep the program moving along and get in as many callers as possible. But anyone who's listening is welcome to call 333-9455 and toll-free 800-222-9455. Professor Taylor, hello.
Yes, good morning.
Thanks for talking with us.
Oh, it's my pleasure.
We certainly appreciate it. If you will forgive such a big and kind of general question to start, we can get into the specifics. But I know this is this area of the country and this time, both things that interest you very much. Why was it that this is something that you chose to spend so much time looking at and writing about?
Well, I focus on the American Revolution, and I've been working on trying to figure out the consequences of that revolution. And that work has drawn me toward looking at the frontier as the place where new communities take shape and where new property takes shape, and the distribution of that property and of those communities contributes to the distribution of power in this new society. And so the real hotbed for all of those developments is, or I should say one of the hotbeds of that, is the Western New York frontier, which is growing as rapidly as any region in the new United States.
I think it's interesting. It perhaps gets people thinking differently about this region if you apply to it the word frontier. I think we're so used to thinking about the frontier as being the West, and I suppose, you know, at one point maybe Illinois was the frontier, but at one point certainly this area that you're talking about in the northeastern United States certainly would qualify.
Well, certainly when the War of the American Revolution ends in 1783, there are very few citizens of the new United States who live west of the Appalachian Mountains, and there were virtually none in Illinois, just a very few settlements of mostly French-descended people. It's primarily a Native American world west of the Appalachian Mountains.
Maybe one way to talk about this is to talk a little bit about the geopolitical interests who are battling here, and sort of set the stage and talk certainly about the three parties, the Americans on one side, the British on the other, and then in between the all of the Indians that make up the Iroquois Confederacy.
At the start of the story that I'm telling, in the 1760s, the 13 colonies are part of a much larger British Empire, and of course they rebel against that empire. But some of the colonies such as Quebec and Nova Scotia, remained loyal to the empire. So the American Revolution is very much a civil war within the British Empire, in which some colonies rebel and form the new United States, and others cling to the empire. So when the war ends, a boundary has to be drawn between the United States and what's left of the empire in North America. And that's a new creation, and it affects the people who find themselves on either side of the line, who have to adjust to either still living in the British Empire and having the American Republic for a neighbor, or are now part of the American Republic and have to adjust to having the British Empire next door. And this especially affects Native peoples who didn't want to be possessed by either of these political entities and did not want to be divided by having a new international boundary run through their midst. And the Native peoples that were probably most affected by this, because they were directly bisected by this new border, were the Iroquois Six Nations. And these were the Mohawk, Oneida, Tuscarora, Cayuga, Onondaga, and Seneca peoples. And of these six nations, four of them primarily helped the British during the war, and two of them primarily helped the United States. So this American Revolution, while it's a civil war within the British Empire, it also becomes a civil war within the Iroquois Six Nations.
Mm-hmm. And here, and also I think an interesting part of the story does indeed have to do with the way that the indigenous people tried to hold their own and then also to play off the other two sides, in a sense, against one another, because they didn't want, as you say, they did not want to be absorbed by either. They had much less power. Certainly, their numbers were much smaller. And here, the two sides, even though the war was over, there was still something of a battle of territory going on. And here, the Native peoples found themselves in the middle, and actually, for some time, did a pretty good job of trying to hold their own and hold back the two sides.
That's right. The Iroquois Six Nations had considerable experience being peoples in between two contending empires, in that for over a century they had been between the French Empire, which had been in Canada, and the British Empire of the 13 colonies along the Atlantic seaboard. And by maintaining a balance of power between these two empires, the Six Nations had been able to preserve their own autonomy and had obtained concessions and trade goods and even presents of trade goods from both of these contending powers. When the British overwhelmed the French in 1759 and 1760 and conquered Canada, that put the Iroquois in a bind, because now they were within the empire rather than between two empires. The Revolution is quite a negative experience for them, in that they find themselves now again between two contending forces, but those two contending forces both invade Iroquois country and burn their villages. So at the end of the war, though, the Iroquois are trying very hard to try to reconstruct a world in which they are a people in between, now between the United States to their south and east, and the British Empire, which is to their north and to the west. Their survival as autonomous peoples will depend on their ability to play off these two powers.
Mm. Our guest in this first hour of Focus 580, Alan Taylor. He is professor of history at the University of California, Davis. The book that describes this piece of history that we're talking about is The Divided Ground. It's published by Knopf, and it's just out recently. Callers are invited. In fact, we have someone here. Why don't we go ahead and bring them into the conversation in the nearby community of Belgium, and that's on our toll-free line, line 4. Hello.
Yes, good morning. I'm interested in your topic, but I think we should set some things down first and try to get an understanding. The Iroquois nation you're referring to, or the six tribes, were mainly in northern New York, but yet the Iroquois came as far west as Michigan, at least, if not farther, and still along the Canadian border on both sides of it, what we consider now the Canadian border anyway. They didn't at that time, obviously. And I would like you to discuss exactly what part of the, how these all were intergrouped, because like you said, it was a federation. And also, maybe a larger topic that might mention a bit is that these groups of native people, where they were far more than a tribe, they really still weren't quite a nation as far as Western Europe was concerned, and how that affected the way things were, because they really didn't have nationhood per se, even though we did call them nations. They were just shy of that, if you see what I'm saying. And that definitely affected the way they were treated and how things turned out for them, didn't it?
Two very good questions. The first is that Iroquoian speakers as a linguistic group is very far-ranging. And certainly in the 17th century, Iroquois war parties were very active all around the Great Lakes. The particular cluster of Iroquoian speakers who belonged to the Confederacy were, on the eve of the Revolution, pretty much to be found in what's now New York State, just to the west of Albany, as far west as the Niagara River. After the Revolution, many of these people are going to become refugees and are going to cross this new border in order to settle within the British Empire, in what's now Ontario or in Quebec. There also had been previously, during the previous wars with the French, many Iroquoian peoples had moved up into the vicinity of Montreal. So you would find Iroquoian-speaking peoples all the way from Montreal on west, certainly to the Detroit vicinity. But I'm focusing on the core group of people, these six nations. Certainly by Western European standards, they don't have what would be called states. They don't have government structures. They don't have the coercive implements of government. They don't have centralized leadership or bureaucracies or really coercive legal cultures to punish crimes in the way Western European nations would. And so this was frustrating to officials from the United States, the British Empire, the French Empire, who hoped that native chiefs could command their people. And in fact, these political entities that we could call either tribes or nations were very loose. They had multiple leaders, and they are really run more by consensus and persuasion than by force.
Thank you very much, sir.
You're welcome.
All right, thank you for the call. Others are certainly welcome. 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. Well, I mentioned at the beginning that you are taking a close look at the lives of two individuals and using their lives as a way of giving some structure and helping you to tell the story, these two men, Samuel Kirkland and Joseph Brant. And I want to give you a chance to talk about them. There are perhaps two other people, though, who are also, maybe we'll take a little bit of a step back, who are also important and then connected with these two men. One of them is Sir William Johnson, and the other the Reverend Wheelock, Eleazar Wheelock. Maybe first we could talk a little bit about William Johnson, who was the British Superintendent of Indian Affairs at one point in from 1755 to 1774, I think is the dates that I have here in front of me. He was also a British Army officer. Tell us about William Johnson.
Well, Johnson is one of the most intriguing and powerful and still mysterious figures of the 18th century. He was born in rather modest circumstances in Ireland and emigrated to the margins of the British Empire during the 1730s and settles in the Mohawk Valley within the colony of New York. And he's an extremely shrewd and adaptable man who saw the importance of the Mohawk community there and set out to become their best friend so that he could become the broker of their trade and their diplomatic relations with the colonial government of New York. And then through that colony with the wider empire, the British Empire. And he made himself then indispensable to that relationship and helped to mobilize the Mohawks to assist the British Empire in this climactic war that will conquer Canada during the later 1750s and early 1760s. As his reward for that, he is knighted. He's given a substantial cash reward from Parliament. He becomes the major British official for dealing with Indian peoples throughout the Northeast. And he becomes an enormous celebrity on both sides of the Atlantic. And this is something that he cultivated very carefully, for he was a very shrewd political infighter within the structures of the British Empire, as well as being very shrewd about native diplomacy. In all of this, he was assisted by the relationships that he formed with Native women who were politically well-connected, and particularly with one Mohawk woman, Molly Brant, who became his common-law wife, and was also his primary political advisor on relations with the Iroquois Six Nations.
Mm-hmm. And here that brings us to the connection with the with Joseph Brant, who was Molly's brother.
That's right.
Then let's introduce the Reverend Wheelock, because here now then brings us this connection between the two men, Kirkland and Brant. Wheelock had a school for school teachers, both Native teachers and whites. His idea was that they would learn the Native languages, and then they would go out and convert the Native people to Christianity. And it was this was the place where the two men, Brant, Joseph Brant, and Samuel Kirkland, met.
That's right. Eliezer Wheelock was in some ways similar to Johnson in that he was an extremely ambitious man who understood the importance of Native peoples and wants to construct his own network of influence using Native peoples. Some differences, though, in that Wheelock was a very devout Congregationalist of Calvinist theology based in Connecticut, whereas Johnson was a much more convivial figure and was an Episcopalian and attached, therefore, to the Church of England and to the larger British Empire. Initially, Wheelock and Johnson had a kind of uneasy cooperation as each needed the other, as Johnson hoped to use Wheelock to help consolidate the influence of British culture among the Six Nations. And Wheelock was trying to use Johnson in order to recruit Indian schoolboys to come and attend Wheelock's school in Connecticut, which was training both school teachers and missionaries who could go into the Iroquois world and try to convert them to Wheelock's brand of Christianity. Now, at that school in Connecticut, two young boys who meet each other, one of them is coming out of the colonial world in Connecticut, and his name is Samuel Kirkland. The other is Joseph Brant, who, as you said, was Molly Brant's younger brother and is coming out of the Mohawk world. And they come together at this school, and they form a lifelong relationship, which is initially friendly but will turn hostile during the Revolution.
What I think is interesting here about both of these men, particularly, I think, Joseph Brant, but I think you could probably say the same thing about Samuel Kirkland, and it carries forward the metaphor suggested by the title of the book, and that they are men who both who seem to have, in a sense, seem to have one foot in each world. Brant, I think, particularly, but again, that may be that it was as true, perhaps almost as true, as Samuel Kirkland, that they were both men who identified with their people, but also with the other side, if you want to put it that way, were interested in fostering some kind of communication between the two. Ultimately, I suppose, were interested in enriching themselves, in a sense, and their people. Let's talk about them in that sense.
Yeah, I mean, they come from two quite different cultural orbits, and they're such radically different languages, the languages of the Six Nations versus the English language of the colonists, so that there were very few people who were fluent in both an Iroquoian language and English. And Brandt and Kirkland were part of this very small subset of people with this kind of fluency. And this then gave them considerable power as go-betweens in a time in which diplomacy between the Six Nations and either the British Empire or the United States is right at the center of political power in military affairs, and will increasingly become at the very center of the process of acquiring lands from native peoples and turning them into private property within either Canada on the British side of the border or within New York on the United States side of the border.
We're just about at the midpoint of this part of Focus 580. Again, just very quickly, let me introduce our guest, Alan Taylor. He's professor of history at University of California, Davis. He's also contributing editor at The New Republic. He's the author of several books about American history, and his most recent is The Divided Ground, Indians, Settlers, and the Northern Borderland of the American Revolution, which takes a look at the way that the border was negotiated and struggled over between the new America on the one side, Britain on the other side, in what is present-day Canada, and the Iroquois, the Native Americans, who were found themselves in between, and particularly the way that the people of the Six Nations tried for as long as they could to, in a sense, hold off both sides, play the two sides off one another, and to maintain their autonomy and control over their lands. The book is published by Knopf. It is out now, and if you would like to read it, look for it in the bookstore. Otherwise, if you'd like to be part of this conversation here, you can give us a call, 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. They're both of these men, Kirkland and Brandt, are very interesting and led interesting and complicated lives. Maybe you could just tell us a little bit more about the two of them.
Certainly both of these men are familiar that they're living in rapidly changing times. And initially they see some grounds for cooperation. Brandt is trying to learn as much as he could about the culture of the colonies and of the British Empire. But he's not doing so because he wants to be a colonist or wants to be British. He wants to be able to understand these very powerful peoples that are increasingly encroaching upon the Indian world so that he can try to preserve the autonomy of his peoples with as neighbors of these powerful newcomers. Kirkland certainly wants to understand the ways of the Six Nations and develops a very sophisticated understanding. But his motives are the opposite of Brandt's, where Brandt is trying to learn about the colonial world so that he can preserve Indian independence. Kirkland is working to try to break down that Indian independence, and he's trying to understand native ways so that he can facilitate that process. And he certainly wants to convert them to the very demanding form of Christianity that he practices, which adheres to a Calvinist theology. And he also wants to convert them to the particular economic way of life that prevails in the colonies, which is a very commercial form of agriculture. He wants to convert them to the system of gender relations that prevails in the colonies, in which men work in agriculture and women work primarily in the household. And he wants to convert them to become within the politics of the new United States, to whittle their lands down so that they live on pretty small reservations as communities within the United States rather than as independent nations that are between the United States and the British Empire.
We have another caller here to bring into the conversation, someone on a cell phone, so we'll get right to them on line number one. Hello.
Hi.
Yes.
I just had a question. I wondered if you could talk a little bit about did American people, well, I guess they're not all Native American, I understand from what you're saying, did they fare better in Canada than they did here? I mean, I understand I'm going better in the future than the particular area that you're looking at, but I was just curious about how people fared with Canadian government versus our
I think the connection was not real good, but I think we got the essence of the question about what the experience of Native peoples were on the Canadian side of the border. Yeah,
and in comparison with the United States,
right?
Certainly, just to start out in the period of time that I'm focusing on, which is approximately from the end of the American Revolution up until about 1820. In that period of time, Native peoples on the Canadian side of the border have a significantly better relationship with the British Empire than do most Indians on the American side of the border. Part of it's just sheer numbers. The number of settlers in Canada is far smaller than you would find on the U.S. side of the border, and therefore the Indians living in places like Ohio and Kentucky and Indiana are under a much greater pressure from thousands of newcomers moving into their country and transforming it to make farms. And that leads to a pretty violent relationship as Native peoples try to stop or at least slow this process of invasion and transformation. On the British side of the border in what's now Canada, the British fear that there's going to be another war with the United States. And, of course, they're right. There will be another war, the War of 1812, which breaks out in that year and will last through 1814. And in anticipation of that war, they understand that they're at a numeric disadvantage because they have so few settlers on their side of the border. And the United States, therefore, has the capacity to raise much larger armies to invade Canada. But the British thought of Indian peoples as something of an equalizer, in that although Indian numbers were relatively small, they were very skilled at the kind of forest warfare that would feature in any war along this borderland. And so the British goal is to cultivate Indian peoples as military allies. Now, from the Native perspective, the positive side of that is that the British put a little less pressure on Indians to give up land. They give them more in the way of presents, and they treat Indians' political leaders with a little more public respect. The negative side is that the British could be quite manipulative if they felt that Indians were becoming a little too independent. And Joseph Brant then felt both sides of these things, as the British would treat him quite well when they thought he was on board with what they wanted to do. But if he seemed to be acting too independently, then they would work very hard to cut him down.
All right. I hope that gets at the question of the call. Let's go to somebody else. This is also another cell phone caller. They're in Champaign, line one. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
I'm curious to know if this Kirkland that you're speaking of is the one after which Kirkland College connected with Hamilton College is named.
Well, there's Hamilton College, and Samuel Kirkland was the founder of that college. And
Okay, but I mean, they named the Women's College Kirkland after him then.
Well, probably.
Yeah.
I would assume so.
Well, it strikes me as funny because my husband is a Hamilton graduate, and it seems to me that their college song makes fun of Amherst for wanting, Lord Amherst and Amherst College for wanting to teach the Indians. and it sounds as if they've changed their mind. I mean, it, from the kind of description you're giving of Kirkland, it doesn't sound as if he really had the values that we would like to see in terms of being open-minded. I know that that's, you know,
right.
That was ages and ages ago, but I could see why they might want to drop the name.
Well, he's I would see him as kind of an ambiguous character on that score. On the one hand, sometimes when you read his journals, you're impressed by his sensitivity
mm-hmm.
To Native culture, which is actually pretty surprising for his generation. And at other times, he just seems to be fairly abrupt and determined to change that culture.
Mm-hmm.
And I think he was himself of two minds. And he will go back and forth in the course of his lifetime. Sometimes he seems pretty controlling. At other times, he seems to understand the limits of his own culture and to have some respect for Native culture. So he's a hard guy to categorize in that way. Now, he was a student of Wheelock. And Wheelock, after running the school in Connecticut, would later go on to found Dartmouth College in New Hampshire.
Mm-hmm.
And he obtained the money for that primarily from philanthropists in Great Britain who thought they were giving money for a school for Indians, a better version of, and a larger version of the school that Wheelock had run in Connecticut. But Wheelock, in fact, converted that school into a college which trained overwhelmingly young white men. And this was something that bitterly disappointed some Indian leaders who thought that this college would be for their benefit. What's striking is that when Wheelock does this, Kirkland is a very harsh critic of Wheelock for taking this money and converting it to a purpose not intended by the donors. But in a later point in his own life, Kirkland does exactly the same thing. He raises money for Hamilton College.
Uh-huh.
He pitches this to donors as something that's going to be of equal benefit to Indian boys as well as boys coming from settlements. But the reality is that it's only a handful of Indians that ever go to this school because they are unable to pay for the tuition. And Wheelock uses the money from the donors in order to build some pretty impressive structures instead of to educate Indian children mm-hmm. on charity scholarships.
How successful was Dartmouth at doing that? I have an ancestor that graduated, I think, in 1806 or something. And according to the family history, he, in fact, could speak an Indian language and did work with Indians.
Well, there are certainly a few graduates of Dartmouth and of Hamilton that will do missionary work among Native peoples, and in the course of that will learn their languages. But there's certainly a very small element among the students who were trained at those two colleges during the 19th century.
Well, thank you. I appreciate your elaborating on that point.
All right. Well, thanks for the call. Others are welcome. 333-9455, toll free, 800-222-9455. Our guest in this hour of Focus 580, Alan Taylor. He's professor of history at University of California, Davis. I'm interested in having you, again, maybe perhaps talk a little bit more about Joseph Brandt. He was, I gather, something of a celebrity in his time. He actually was taken to England. He met with the king, George III. He had his portrait painted by some celebrated British painters. He was, according to one source that I looked at, said that he might in fact have been the most well-known, the most famous Native American of his time.
I think that's certainly true. He paid very close attention when he was growing up to how Sir William Johnson operated. And in many ways modeled his own approach and his own life after Johnson. He understood how to obtain celebrity. He knew how to cultivate powerful men. He was highly literate and could write in both Mohawk and in English. And he accumulated the finer things of life. He lived in a very nice house. He owned some slaves. He had quite exquisite possessions, some of which were given to him as presents by English aristocrats and by the king himself. So Brant knew how to cultivate powerful people, and he knew how to establish his own celebrity. He also did this among the elite that's running the new United States, so that he visited Philadelphia when it was the capital and was wined and dined by George Washington and Alexander Hamilton and Thomas Jefferson. So that Brant was very well connected, and he built these connections, partly, of course, to serve himself, but as part of a larger drive to try to maintain the power of the Six Nations, but with himself very much as a central figure in the Six Nations.
As you've outlined it here, the situation is that we have this border land, we have the area that occupied by the Iroquois, the Six Nations, a lot of territory, not so many people, but a lot of territory. And then they are in between the British on the one side, who are in present-day Canada, and the United States on the other, with the British and the Americans also wanting to hold and control as much territory as possible, with their eyes on this territory where the native people live. And the native people, their interest is in maintaining their control, their autonomy. They didn't really want to be either part of the United States on the one hand or part of Britain on the other. They didn't want their lands divided by a border between the two that would run through it. So what they were interested in is trying to maintain as much autonomy and control as possible, not to give lands away, not to sell them. Can you talk a little bit about how the native people, what they did in the effort to try to maintain that kind of autonomy as they were in this difficult position in between the two powers, the Americans on the one side and the British on the other?
Right. Well, when the British and the Americans make peace to end their war in 1783, they draw up this boundary that runs essentially through the middle of the Great Lakes, and then down the St. Lawrence River, and then across northern New York and northern New England. This is a border that is a very generous one when granted, given the military situation in 1783. And it shocks Indian peoples that they now have this border running through their midst, and if they have to be on one side or the other, they prefer to be on the British Empire side of things, since most of them had fought to help the British, and they don't trust the Americans with their many settlers aggressively moving westward. So the British come to regret that border pretty quickly, and a kind of Cold War settles in during the later 1780s and early 1790s as the British kind of fudge that boundary by keeping forts with their soldiers in them on the American side of that border and by providing military assistance to Indians, some of whom in the Ohio country are involved in a war with the United States. And the Americans then are hoping that they can try to reach a peace with those native peoples and roll the British back and get the British to give up those forts and accept the peace treaty boundary that had been negotiated in 1783. In this jockeying and this kind of Cold War, the Americans are trying to use the Iroquois Six Nations as go-betweens to try to negotiate peace. And they're trying to prevent those Six Nations from swinging entirely over into the British interest. So in this, the Americans are playing this very tricky balancing act where they're trying on the one hand to be friendly to the Six Nations. On the other hand, they're also trying to work their settlements in and all around the Six Nations so that they will become these smaller enclaves surrounded by settlements and therefore subject to more influence from the United States, and therefore more likely, in the case of a future war with the British, more likely to help the United States in war rather than to help the British.
The Native people did something interesting, or at least to try to adopt an interesting sort of strategy as a way of holding on to land. They didn't want it to be taken. They didn't want to sell it, so they tried to lease it.
That's right. This was something that really came as a great surprise to me when I was doing this project. I discovered that many Native peoples were trying to avoid selling their lands. Now, that's a familiar story. They don't want to sell their lands. They want to keep their lands. But they recognize that they're greatly outnumbered by these settlers, and the settlers are moving in. And so some Native leaders, including Brant, said, we can't really keep them out. What we can do, however, is manage the process by which they acquire land. So rather than sell lands for a pittance to either the British government in Canada or to the American state of New York, what we want to do is directly lease land to these settlers so that the settlers will be paying us a rent every year. And there are some advantages to doing this. One, they'll get more money, and they will get a steady income year after year from these settlements. And they will retain the ultimate title to the land and the political sovereignty that goes with it. So this is a far better mode of transferring Indian lands into the possession of settlers. It's far better for Native peoples than selling it outright for very small prices to governments, which, of course, would turn around and sell those lands to land speculators who would then retail the lands to actual settlers. So the Indians are trying to cut out these middlemen of governments and speculators by dealing directly with settlers and, in a way, capturing these settlers as rent-paying tenants on Indian lands.
It's interesting that they would make this choice to try to work within the existing political economic system, if you will, rather than trying to protect their interest by force of arms. And I suppose you could make the argument that they would realize quite clearly that was a losing proposition because they, as you say, they were simply outnumbered. There were far more Americans than there were people of the Six Nations. But it seems to me to show a remarkable kind of adaptability, I suppose, to the conditions for them to take that kind of strategy. I mean, ultimately, it was not successful. Again, perhaps it was simply an issue of numbers. But interesting that they would have adopted that kind of strategy.
Right. I mean, our usual image is of Indian peoples as kind of timeless and very slow to adapt, and they just want to preserve a very traditional way of life. And there are certainly powerful traditions that they are trying to preserve, and they are trying to preserve their cultural distinction. On the other hand, they're also highly creative and adaptive, much more so than I think we usually recognize. And so they well understood that they're enormously outnumbered. They also understand that they greatly benefit from and need trade with non-Native peoples. And so they're trying to work out a successful relationship by which they can preserve their distinctive identity and in the course in their political autonomy. And to do this, they have to understand the culture of the settler peoples, and they have to try to find compromise ways by which they can turn that culture to their own advantage. And they could look at the settler society, and they could see these wealthy landlords along the Hudson River Valley who are renting lands and getting a substantial income every year, and they're saying to themselves, why not us? We got all this really good land. We will rent it to settlers. We will get a substantial income every year, and we will preserve our autonomy and our distinctiveness by pursuing that strategy.
Mm-hmm. We've talked a little bit about the fact that here what you're interested in doing in the book is looking at how it is that essentially these three powers, the British, the Americans, and the Iroquois, tried to work out all of their various interests and how they ultimately established the border between what is now the United States and Canada, and that you use the lives of the two men in a sense to try to help tell the story. It seems that for both of them, though, by the time that they go through the course of their lives and at the end of their lives, that they would have felt that those things that they would have hoped to have achieved, particularly when they were younger, they would have to recognize that that all of that had been a failure. I don't know if they would regard themselves as having been a failure, but that certainly the hopes and the ambitions that they would have had at when they were younger, at the point of the end of their lives, they would have recognized that that those were almost all unfulfilled.
I'd mostly agree with that. It's certainly the case that Kirkland does not succeed in transforming the Indian world as thoroughly and as rapidly as he had anticipated, and Brandt is not able to preserve the unity of the Six Nations as he had hoped, and is not able to preserve the control of his particular group of Six Nations people who live along the Grand River Valley in what's now Ontario to preserve their position as well as he would have hoped. Brandt may have more grounds to have felt that he achieved more of his goals than Kirkland did, in that I think Brandt certainly has powerful disappointments, but his people are still a very significant element and will be essential to the British effort to hold on to Canada in the War of 1812. But on balance, it's a story of men who have, as young men, compelling and optimistic visions, and find themselves engaged with larger forces that they can't control, and experience very deep frustrations, and to various degrees try to reconcile themselves to the limits of what they can achieve in their lives.
So how now, enlarging the frame then, how does this story and their story and then the story of this piece of history in this region, how does that fit into the larger American story, and in what sense is this important?
Right. Well, I see the United States and also Canada as societies that built themselves through expansion westward, obtaining new lands, producing new communities, and producing widespread private property ownership for thousands and thousands of people, who then have their allegiance tied to the governments that underwrite their title to the lands, and which provide them a political framework and provide them with military protection. And so the United States and the British Empire and Canada at the approximate start of this story, at the end of the American Revolution, both are quite weak and both are quite fearful of the other, and are both quite desperate to build their own economic and demographic and political power by growing settlements and spreading them westward and pinning down native peoples on reservations within these settlements. So I see the story that I tell here is certainly a case study. It's not about all of North America by any means. But I think it's revealing about what happens throughout the whole continent, and it's how the United States constituted itself, and it's how Canada constituted itself through this process of expansion, of community building, and of property building.
Well, we are going to have to stop at that because we've come to the end of the time. Once again, if you're interested in reading the book, it's The Divided Ground, Indians, Settlers, and the Northern Borderland of the American Revolution. The book is published by Knopf, is out now, by our guest, Alan Taylor. He's professor of history at the University of California, Davis, has written a number of books about American history, including the book William Cooperstown, which was published in 1995. It's about the history of Cooperstown, New York, and the family that founded the town, and it won the Bancroft and the Pulitzer Prize, two rather prestigious awards for writing of history. So you might take a look at that book as well as the newest one. And we want to say to you, Professor Taylor, thank you very much for talking with us.
Well, thank you. It's been my pleasure.